Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We have a very large audience today, and I think I say that every week, but in fact, today it is terrific. I attribute that to three things. First is your interest in the JPC. Second, in the fact that it is meteorological spring on Saturday, and people are thinking of new things to do. And third, that our guest today is Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. So first we do the introduction, and then, Jonathan, if you've heard the introduction before, you'll hear it again. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization established in 1985, providing analysis of policy, both foreign and domestic. We support strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. We support the government of Israel in its quest to secure the border and the people of Israel and force the elimination of Hamas from military or governing capabilities. Because it's become clear that negotiating for a ceasefire only provides Hamas with a longer timeline for terrorism and destruction. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. And we add to that right now the uncovering of where your tax dollars are going. You can read our publications, insight articles, and our magazine and Focus Quarterly on the website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. You can also find a lot of our previous webinars there. You can binge watch. It's great with a glass of wine. You can find Jonathan Shanzer in his previous incarnations, too. We're going to talk today about two aspects of what's going on in Gaza. One is the one we advertised, President Trump's plan for Gaza, which was not unexpectedly shocking. UAE Ambassador to Washington, however, Youssef Al-Otaiba, called it difficult, but said, "We are in the solution-seeking business. We just don't know it's going to land yet." He added, "I don't see the alternative to what's being proposed. I really don't." That's what he said. But shortly after a burst of very negative reaction from Egypt and Jordan, they, along with UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait and Bahrain and Oman, met in Riyadh to talk about Gaza. They don't know what they're doing yet, but something's happening, and it's worth exploring. But no plan for Gaza's future can be implemented without a plan to get rid of Hamas. So, Jonathan will also talk about the government of Israel's plans for Gaza before reconstruction can begin. John Shanzer, as I mentioned, is Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He worked previously as a terror finance analyst at the Department of the Treasury, where he played a major role in the designation of numerous terrorist financiers. He has spent time at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the Middle East Forum, and he actually sat in my chair here at the JPC. John, I hope I'm living up to your standards. He is the author of the book Gaza 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. And that's a really important book because the rocket war of 2021 seems very far away, but it should be a reminder that it ended in a ceasefire. And the ceasefire lasted until October 6th, 2023. So never forget where we've been. Also, read his other previous books for the same reason: State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine, and Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups, and the Next Generation of Terror. He has written hundreds of articles on the Middle East. He has appeared on hundreds of programs. He has testified many, many times before Congress, and I'm thrilled to have him with us today to share what he knows with us. Jonathan Shanzer, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Great to be with everybody today. Love to hear that In Focus is still going strong. That was a concept I came up with on the back of a napkin. I think it was 2007, and love to still see those kicking around in Washington. And I think it continues to go from strength to strength, thanks to your leadership, Shoshana and Matt Brooks and others. I want to speak for just a few minutes about what occurred a few weeks ago during that now famous Bibi visit to the White House, his first meeting with Donald Trump, Donald Trump's first meeting with any foreign leader. I actually believe that that meeting was perhaps one of the most consequential, if not the most consequential, meeting between an American president and an Israeli prime minister. And I'm going to get to why I think that. But let me just begin by highlighting the impact of that short statement by the president. He was reading off of a small piece of paper that highlighted what appeared to be a plan of sorts. He was not reading it off the cuff. This was not some kind of idea that struck him just as he was walking out to answer questions from the press. This was something that he had up his sleeve or in his pocket, and he was intent upon reading it. Now, let's just first acknowledge this is the disruptor in chief. This is a man who continues to drop ideas, whether they are welcomed or not, and it forces everyone to run for cover when the impact is felt, and the impact was immediate. My argument is that the intended audience for this was not the Israelis. I don't think it was actually the Jordanians or the Egyptians or the Palestinians, the Gaza people. I think it was intended for the people of Saudi Arabia, for the government of Saudi Arabia. At the end of the day, the president was on the precipice, on the 2-yard line, if you will, of remaking the Middle East back in 2020. He had the Saudis on the precipice of of joining, whether we want to call it the Abraham Accords or we can call it the Isaac and Ishmael agreements. I don't care what you want to, describe it. It was normalization. That was, I mean, it felt like minutes away from securing such a deal after the president had already locked in the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and Sudan. Of course, Sudan's no longer an agreement because it's barely a country, but all of these things had been done under the president's previous term. And now that he is back, he's got unfinished business. And so when he starts to talk about reimagining the region or shattering norms, he's looking really at the region writ large. And I think that needs to be understood here, that the intended audience was very likely Saudi Arabia and perhaps some of Saudi Arabia's subservient countries, countries that are dependent in part or in whole upon Saudi Arabian largesse. But at the end of the day, this was a norm-busting exercise and one that I thoroughly enjoyed. This idea that no Palestinian can or should ever be moved from land that has been earmarked for the Palestinian cause. This dates back to 1949. It is sclerotic and ossified thinking that has been enshrined by the Arab League. It has been embraced by just about every Arab country, and it's been going on, in my view, for about 7 decades too long. Now, that said, I think there are limits to what the president floated. He talked about possibly Jordan taking in Gaza refugees as a temporary measure while the world, led by the United States, would rebuild the Gaza Strip and turn it into some kind of Mediterranean, I don't know, tropical resort or something. Gaza Lago, as I think we all should start calling it. I think Jordan is the exact wrong place for Palestinians to go in large numbers. This is a country that we want to keep stable at the moment. It is already 85% Palestinian. It is destabilized. It is not being run well by the government in Amman. It has lost the faith of its people. This is not a country we want to destabilize further. The ramifications of a collapse of Jordan in any way would be not positive. And we've already seen a huge number of refugees coming in from Syria into the country in recent years, large numbers of Palestinians in the past. Now, there are going to be those who will say that Jordan is already Palestine, and so why not? Well, it all really depends, in my view, about how much you value a stable Jordan. I value a stable Jordan, and that's why I think that right now pushing the Jordanians to accept tens of thousands or 100,000 or 500,000 refugees is probably not a good thing. I think we want to keep the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel intact for as long as we possibly can, because this is a good thing. This is a buffer zone that Jordan has created. Now, there are still problems between Jordan and Israel. The rhetoric is terrible. The border security is bad. But these things cannot be fixed if the Jordanians are getting deluged with Gaza refugees. We heard a bit about Egypt possibly taking in refugees. I do think that that is a more feasible outcome. You have a sparsely populated Sinai Peninsula. This is a place where I think you could rather easily absorb Gaza refugees. However, they would A, need to be willing to go. Egypt needs to agree to this, and there needs to be law and order that presides, and there needs to be money provided for the Egyptians to take in large numbers of people that probably don't have the means to feed themselves or to handle the overhead of however long they would need to live there. So I think it's a big question mark as far as Egypt is concerned. I will say this: we, for those who saw it, we had Yair Lapid, the opposition leader for Israel. He came to FDD the other day, and he floated a new plan. His plan is that Egypt should go into the Gaza Strip and actually run the reconstruction there. I will say, with all respect to Mr. Lapid and to my colleagues who, engaged in discussion with him, it's the exact wrong idea right now. The Egyptians are they're not to be trusted at this moment. We have seen the evidence of the tunnels. We have seen the smuggling that has continued from before 10/7 and after 10/7. This is not a country that I would like to entrust with something as sensitive and as delicate and as combustible as the Gaza Strip. They failed to maintain order just along the Philadelphia corridor, and that was bad enough. The idea that they should take responsibility for all of Gaza, no, just that's something that I think should not be entertained. Now, people have asked, where could Gazan refugees go? There's a long list, actually. Sub-Saharan Africa, there are Muslim countries that I think could be convinced to take in Gaza refugees. Malaysia, Indonesia, Central Asia. These are all countries that don't have the Arab world. Again, that's sclerotic, ossified, just really dysfunctional view of the Palestinian cause and their willingness to sacrifice every Palestinian as a symbol to the Palestinian cause. Even if the Palestinians don't want to be symbols themselves, they force that upon them, and that needs to end. And I think you have countries that could be convinced because they are not Arab, but also are Muslim and care about the future of this small group of people. We could see maybe some solutions emerge. I personally like the idea of saddling the responsibility for this with Qatar and Turkey, the two primary patrons of Hamas in the Muslim world. I don't expect the US to force it upon them, but I think it would be wise policy if we did make them pay for the war that they have started and that they have actually enabled to continue for the last 16 months. Okay, now for the end game in Gaza, because I think no matter what happens, we need to see Hamas weakened and destroyed. We need to see the war end, this war that we've been watching for the last 16 months. It cannot continue if the goal is to try to begin to bring order and calm to the region. This needs to settle itself, and we are not done. We've had a pause. And I think a lot of people mistake the pause with an end to the conflict. We are not. Right? There were actually three different ceasefires that took place during Israel's War of Independence. Two of them led to additional war, right? And wars can stop and go. They have a cadence of their own. This war, right now, as I see it, is very likely to go back into a hot phase. We all know what has happened over the last month or so. We've seen the exchanges of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. We have ended phase one. We've just reached the end of it with the return of an additional four bodies to Israel and the release of another large number of terrorists that had been in Israeli custody. There is a chance from friends in Israel that we will head into what they're calling phase 1.5, where we could see the release of additional hostages, alive or dead, in exchange for either the release of additional terrorists, or we could see a surge in humanitarian assistance. People forget that right now we're heading into Ramadan. And the government in Gaza, the Hamas-led government in Gaza, is not particularly loved or popular at this moment, despite what they're trying to project, because they have brought misery upon the people. So the people are heading into a holiday where they are supposed to eat at night and have celebrations at night. And right now, Hamas might benefit from seeing Israel deliver more, and that may help extend the period of calm that we have. But by the way, it could easily hasten it, as we have seen before, and as I had written about back when I was working at the Jewish Policy Center. This is not new. We're talking about Ramadan being exploited by jihadi groups to try to foment violence across the rest of the region, to try to galvanize the entire Arab world, the entire Muslim world against Israel. That is a possibility as well. But we are absolutely at an intersection where we could be at the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. But I think there are still chapters to be written here. So what happens if the ceasefire goes to phase two or goes to phase even three? They're to see the postponement conflict. It will be inevitable because Hamas will survive. Iran will have an opportunity to reconstitute and rebuild its ballistic missile capabilities and its air defenses. Hezbollah will have an opportunity to also rebuild. The likelihood of a phase two or phase three of the hostage deal seems very low to me. I know Stephen Witkoff is trying to get to phase two and phase three. I don't believe that this is where the Israeli government is. I'm not even sure that this is where Hamas wants to be. I think they're actually not ready to cede defeat and they're itching for more battle. And so then comes the question of what happens if we do return. And I think that we have really not a lot of there's not a lot of choose your own adventure here. I think things are going to go according to the way that the intelligence is showing it in Israel, and I think it's quite obvious to us. It's logical. If war starts back up again, Israel will, of course, be in the Gaza Strip. I don't think it will be the same intensity of fighting as we saw before. It will be more like thrusts into Gaza. It will be special operations against specific clusters of Hamas terrorists, as well as some of their hardware. They do not have nearly, I mean, I don't even think they have a quarter of what they had when they started. The fighting force has dropped from, let's say, 30 or 35,000 to 10,000 or even 5,000. Most of those that have joined the ranks of Hamas to fight are not trained. They're not nearly as prepared to face Israelis on the battlefield as those that have already been cut down on the battlefield. So you're likely to see a lopsided battle, perhaps a grim one at that, in the Gaza Strip. Now, the big question becomes from there, will Hezbollah join again? They are weakened significantly. They have lost two-thirds of their arsenal. They have lost the strength of the Syrian regime that they used to draw from. In general, I think there are questions out there about the trajectory of Hezbollah now that the government there and the Lebanese armed forces are trying, maybe half-heartedly, but they're trying to gain a modicum of control there. We don't know, but I think right now it's safe to say that Hezbollah is weaker and probably less inclined to fight. There is no Shiite militia presence in Syria, so that's another front that we can void out in our calculus. The Shiite militias in Iraq that have fired at troops in the past, look, they remember Donald Trump from the last time around. He was the one who killed Qasem Soleimani in the head of one of their top militias back in 2020. I don't know if they're ready to go back again for another round with Donald Trump. The Iranian regime is weaker. They don't have the ballistic missiles, they don't have the air defense. What that really leaves us with right now are two fronts. One is the West Bank, which is ongoing anyway. As we know, the Israelis have been doing a lot of work there at night, where the IDF has gone in and they have arrested people and they have killed terrorists and they have destroyed weapons caches and they've done a lot of other things to try to keep a lid on the violence there. I see that as sunk cost. The Israelis are going to be battling in the West Bank for some time. The big question in my mind right now is the Houthis. The Houthis have vowed to fight if Israel returns to the battlefield. We are very likely to see ballistic missiles starting to fly. Now, this will be the first time that Donald Trump, in his second term, will have a brush with the Houthis in this way. You have to remember, the Houthis are something of a partisan issue at this point for the president. He was the one who designated the Houthis, put them on the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, and then Biden took them off. He's put them back on again. If the Houthis begin to stir up trouble in the region, look, it's not just that it's the Houthis, it's that the Chinese are watching, the Russians are watching. There is potentially a point that Donald Trump will have to make using the Houthis to make it. I think that will be a crucial moment in this war because they have been sort of the wild card, the Houthis have been. But then I think we have another question that lingers. I mentioned at the top that I believe that the president and the prime minister of Israel have had an incredibly consequential meeting. They met several weeks ago in the White House, and yes, they talked about the day after. And yes, that's where the disruptor in chief dropped the question or the dropped the specter of Gaza Lago and everybody started going crazy. But lost in all of that is the fact that these are two men that had 4 years ago been talking about a possible Israeli strike on Iran's nuclear facilities, that they talked about the maximum pressure campaign and squeezing the regime until it collapses, possibly supporting the Iranian people in their struggle against their tyranny. These are things that are now back on the table. I'm not telling you right now that he has secured a green light from attack. I'm not telling you that he has secured an agreement to work together to undermine the regime. What I can tell you is that conversation is ongoing. And that conversation will continue if the Gaza war starts back up again. And that will hasten some of the decision making because wars have a way of forcing you to make choices. This is sort of the unintended consequence of war all the time. You are forced to move more quickly as a means to mitigate damage, to protect forces, to protect your own people. I suspect that that will be the path that we go on. I don't have a timeline. I don't have predictions. But what I can tell you is we appear to be heading into a second phase of this war. The politics have changed. The weapons that Israel now possesses, their arsenals are now more full. They have plans that they have worked on over the last several months as things have gone quiet. This is a consequential intersection that we have arrived at. And I suspect we will learn a lot and see some fireworks in the weeks to come. I'll leave it there. I hope I've stuck to my time. I've adhered to my limit, and I'll hand it back to you, Shoshana.
You have no limit, Jonathan. You can talk all day and we'll be perfectly happy. However, you have raised a couple of questions for us. Secretary of State Rubio made a very strong statement about the need to return the hostages. He demanded that they return. He used the word demand, which raises a question. What is the United States, in your opinion, prepared to do to back up those demands? President Trump also said hell will break out in Gaza, and he seemed perfectly content with the idea that Israel would create the hell. But what are we supposed to do about it? He also said the Houthis are a problem. What are we prepared to do about it? Is this a case, in your view, and I'm not sure anybody knows this yet, where the United States makes demands that it assumes Israel will carry out for them? Or do you think we're actually planning to do something about these things?
Look, I don't know the answer to this. And by the way, I'm not sure Trump knows the answer to this, right? I mean, again, a disruptor is just one way to put it. I mean, he's utterly unpredictable, and that's we know that about him. What I think I would say right now is to invoke the words of the journalist Celina Zito. who has covered Trump World and covered the president, that we should take him seriously but not literally. And I think that's the guidance here, is that he is deadly serious about getting the hostages back. He's deadly serious about containing the regime. He's deadly serious about making sure that the Houthis don't re-engage in the way that they have. And that if he's crossed, he may take action, or he may deputize or at least authorize the Israelis, give them a green light to do things that perhaps the Biden administration did not do before. I don't know what he has in mind. I don't know what Marco Rubio has in mind. Secretary of State, I think, again, tough language. We see also tough language from Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, right? Calling Hamas pure evil and really making it unequivocal. Look, I think part of this is the political pressure that Hamas is going to feel. It's going to feel isolated right now. I think that Hamas's patrons are feeling isolated right now. The Qataris are moving much more quickly than they did when Biden was in power. They're moving with a speed that I think underscores the pressure that they are under from the Trump administration. All of that, I think, is good. And again, I think we are in a position now, they're calling it phase 1.5, where political pressure is actually driving the release potentially of other hostages and forcing this to continue, even if it doesn't hew to phase two as written. And I think we should ride that for as long as we can. But the hostages that remain, now that we've gotten past phase one, this is, well, let me just say, it's a slippery slope for Israelis. When I was in Israel about a month ago, I was able to speak to some folks who, were close to the ceasefire talks. And what they said was there was no intent to go to phase two, which would mean very clearly that not everybody comes home. And there is, I think, a sense in Israel that perhaps those that are still being held, they are soldiers. They are men of fighting age. And the price that they knew that they could pay could yet be the price that they will. Because if Israel continues down this road and lets out thousands more prisoners that have been in Israeli jails for violent terrorist crimes, and the Israelis agree to allow Hamas to live, which is embedded in phase two and phase three of this deal, that's something. I mean, look, it would bring down Bibi's government, and it could, at the end of the day, really, erode Israel's deterrence, which I think even those in the IDF that want the hostages home have to acknowledge. So some painful decisions, I think, right now for the Israelis, regardless of what we hear from Trump, what he says, what he implies, what they're able to do or not able to do. At the end of the day, I think this is an Israeli decision about whether they want to continue to negotiate for the lives of those hostages, or even the bodies of those hostages still being held, or whether it's time to go back, because that is the imperative, the strategic imperative. I think that's the debate right now, not what our people are saying here in Washington, not what our leadership is conveying abroad.
So you've answered a question that we got here, because it would appear from the U.S. side that Israel has a green light to do whatever it wants. But what you're saying is the green light isn't necessary, isn't dispositive. The Israelis have to make a decision regardless of having a green light, and they may not take the green light.
I've been saying that Benjamin Netanyahu is a bit like the dog that caught the mailman.
Now what?
Right. I mean, so he has a week in Iran. He's got a week in Hezbollah. He's got, a U.S. president that's on his side, telling everybody Israel is, a hand in the region. Now he has to decide what he's going to do that will have po serious political ramifications. He's got an IDF that is tired. He's got a right-wing coalition that doesn't want to let him end the war. He's got a left-leaning opposition that wants every hostage home. He has to navigate all of this, and he's still trying to figure out what is he going to do about Iran. because that's really his priority. Gaza is actually not. As important as Gaza may be, it's not an existential threat to Israel. It's the Iranian nuclear program that is. And so he's got a lot of trade-offs that he's going to have to consider here. But in the meantime, he's holding a lot of cards. He just doesn't know which way to play them.
Okay, so he's holding cards. I wonder if he has fewer cards today than he had, let's say, 6 weeks ago. This is the question of Israeli deterrence. There was a moment, especially after the pagers, or after Bashar Assad stepped down, or after this or after that, when Israel was clearly in the ascendancy. It was the strong horse. Everybody's looking at this, especially the pagers, because it was hard not to laugh, and say that Israel could do whatever it wanted to do in the region. So, first question. When you see Hamas giving back the hostages in the disgusting animalistic way they're giving them back, and the parades and the dancing children and all of that sort of stuff, and still keeping hostages. And in fact, they had two hostages sitting in an ambulance watching other people being released. They've gone to the bottom of the pile. But what does that do to Israel's image when it simply accepts that? And I mean Israel's image in the region. I'm not talking about the American Jewish community. I'm not talking about the government of the United States. In the region, does that reduce Israel's strong horse profile to sit there and take those disgusting things and not respond to them?
So, I mean, I think a couple of things to unpack, and these are, I think, crucial questions to answer. The first thing that I'll say is when Israel was arguably at its strongest point after the Operation Castration, as we will call it, in Lebanon, and when they destroyed the radars of the S-300s and left the skies over Iran naked, they had another 3 months where they were beholden to Biden administration foreign policy. They could not act. Their agreement with the Biden administration was that they were going to do what they did, and then they were going to let diplomacy take over. And that's exactly what happened. And we actually began to see Stephen Witkoff. This was unprecedented. Stephen Witkoff, the president's chief negotiator on the Middle East, was in the region working with the Qataris and dealing with all the other regional actors before the Trump administration had even started. The Biden folks had welcomed him in, and the Israelis were in a position where they had to let a bipartisan partnership guide the diplomacy. Now, so they were effectively powerless. They could have violated this, but it would have done, I think, really just unimaginable damage to the U.S.-Israel relationship, by the way, on both sides of the aisle. Trump didn't want them going to war while he was going to ascend to the presidency for the second time. Biden didn't want the war to continue because that's just where he always was. So now you have, what are we, 6, 7 weeks into a new administration? Not even 5 weeks into a new administration. The question is, has Israel projected power so far? Soft power, hard power? Look, hard power, not so much. I guess you could argue that some of what they've done in the West Bank or some of the attacks that they've done in Lebanon, but it's been patrolling, it's been policing, it's, one-off attacks, things like that. It's defense at the end of the day. Soft power projection, arguably as high as it's ever been.
Really?
Well, I mean, Bibi was the first foreign leader to go to the White House. The president has told him he can do whatever the hell he wants. The implication here is that Israel has full backing from the United States. The U.S. is now, we've handed over all of the weapons that were being held up, those 1,800 MK-84 bombs, the 2,000-pound bombs. They're all in Israel now. Fuses attached, guidance kits ready. The Israelis have what they need to do a lot more damage to their enemies. So, in the sense, Israel has been sitting and allowing for Trump to, push people to act differently, to get hostages out. And by the way, the other thing that I've heard from the Israelis, even those that are not loving the hostage deal, we need to understand that the fewer hostages that remain in Gaza right now, in Hamas custody right now, the less leverage that Hamas has over Israel in future battles. Israelis, it's funny. People talk about, oh gosh, they've been so brutal in Gaza, and the fighting has been horrific. The Israelis have been fighting with one hand tied behind their back for the last 16 months because they've not been attacking the tunnels because they've been fearful of, hitting a civilian, hitting a hostage. What I'm trying to get at right now is that I think all of the tables have turned. You've got all these other weaker actors right now. They're afraid to tussle with Israel. The one really, bad actor, the Houthis, I think they understand that they could actually cross a line. I look right now at Israel. I think they have a lot right now, a lot of cards. I don't think they know which ones they want to play, but the soft power has grown. The potential for hard power is there and probably augmented from where it was, even at their highest point of strength back in October. So I see very positive things for Israel. They're talking right now not about defending against their enemies. They're actually talking about starting to remake the map of the Middle East. It is a very different dialogue right now in Israel. Now, I don't know if they have a full vision for how the Middle East might look, but one gets a sense that there are big tectonic shifts that could occur and that Israel could help precipitate.
Is this helped along by the fact, particularly if you're looking at the Gulf states, and I know that Saudi Arabia is central to Israel's thinking about the future, when the Saudis and other Gulf states, or the Egyptians or the Jordanians, watch Trump treating Netanyahu as a partner in all these things, but also treating the Europeans as something less than a partner and the Ukrainians as something less than a partner? Is this helping Israel? Is this helping the Saudis and others see Israel again as a stronger horse? This is where they want to go.
There's a piece by my old colleague John Hanna today in the Times of Israel, where he talks about how the Saudis were blindsided by the Trump Gaza Lago statement and how it sent them scrambling and it was positive. I don't doubt that, but I would also argue that when Israel looks strong, I think it is a signal to the rest of the Arab world that they can join this. And I would argue that what the Israelis did in October in the operations against Hezbollah, the targeted strikes against Iran's air defenses and ballistic missile production facilities, I think just the fact that they're winning in Gaza, even with the challenges and the issues that still lie ahead, I don't think there's any doubt in their mind that things are pointing in the direction of a normalization agreement. To me, I think the biggest challenge for them is not knowing what lies ahead in another 4 years. That we've had just this bipolar foreign policy as it relates to Iran, and they can't take big risks unless they know that Iran is defeated. That the threat to them has dissipated and that the coast is clear. These look the Gulf Arab states, Saudis are, I think, chief among them, but none of them are profiles in courage. They are, relatively weak militaries. They travel in packs. They only make this. They talk big games and they got a lot of money, but they make safe moves at the end of the day. And what Israel, I think, and the United States, we need to be thinking about is how to show these Arab states that it's safe to take a step in the direction of normalization. I think they probably see it as safer than it looked under Biden. For sure, I think that. But we've got a few other steps, I think, to take in order to get everybody singing from the same sheet of music and ready to go in the direction of normalization. And again, what I think, I think everybody knows this, but if the Saudis go in that direction, it's hard to imagine how this doesn't go viral across the Muslim world. They have a leadership role to play. It's not just financial, it's religious, it's cultural. It used to be that, that the Egyptians and the Jordanians and maybe the Syrians were the heart of the Arab world. The capital was the capitals were Cairo, Amman, and Damascus. You look where we are now. I mean, Cairo, a shambles. Jordan, not in great shape. Damascus, not even an Arab country right now. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a Turkish sanjak, as we would probably call it. The power has shifted. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about it anymore. The power has shifted to the Gulf. And so if the Gulfies all move in this direction, right? Emirates already have, Bahrain already has. Saudi does this, the domino effect could really be remarkable.
So I'm going to leap over like five questions that I was going to ask you, but let's just go to the end here. Does it require then removing either the nuclear capability of Iran or the government of Iran? We got to go to, do we have to get rid of it?
Do I have to choose? I
No.
mean, no,
I
I
mean,
mean,
we can do
I
both.
yeah, I
It's
mean, I look,
fine.
I think the nuclear stuff is obviously important. That's, you know, that's eliminating an existential threat to Israel, and by the way, to Europe and to the rest of the Arab world. It's not just Israel. But then there's the other part of it, which is the regime itself continues to wield power over its proxies, and these proxies exist, you know, in lots of different places and manifest in different ways. For I think the rest of the region to understand that it's safe, it needs to be gone. And that's why, you know, I mean, at FTD we've done a lot of work, not just identifying the nuclear sites that need to be targeted, but we're also really talking about maximum pressure. The, you know, renewed sanctions program that I think is underway. I think we, you know, it's funny you mentioned Doge. Look, I'm all for cutting fat, but what we really need are people that can help implement policies like maximum pressure. And I think right now we're still running on a skeleton crew. And I think there's, you know, kind of a happy medium that we're going to have to reach as we look at government reform, but also making sure that there are enough bodies there to execute on the policies that are most important to us. But in addition to maximum pressure, there's also the policy that my colleagues call maximum support, which is supporting the people of Iran who hate their regime. I mean, they are suffering under tyranny. It cannot be described in any other way. And so the US, the Israelis, some of our other friends around the region need to give the people of Iran the support that they need. It could be intelligence, it could be financial, it could be weapons, it could be any of the above, all of the above for that matter. But at the end of the day, if we want the regime to go down, it won't just happen from military action. And by the way, the Israelis lack a lot of the tools that are needed to do all the jobs that we're talking about here. It will be much more effective if we've got on the ground support from the people who are thirsty for our help.
So let me boost In Focus Quarterly here because the winter issue of In Focus, which you can find online if you like, is our Iran issue. And the issue is called Iran, Freedom or Fire. It is not a question, it is a statement. And in there, by the way, you will find a couple of great articles by people from FDD. So, you know, it comes together. But what I hear you saying is never mind this two-state solution conversation, never mind this little thing or that little thing. Go to the source of the regional problem. And if you go to the source of the regional problem and you resolve it, other people will suddenly poke their heads up and say, oh, we can live with this.
It's the changing of the map, Shoshana really is. And that's why I think these, you know, the Israelis are look, I don't know what their plans are at the end of the day. They told me they'd have to kill me, right? I mean, that's really not the point. But I think, you know, when you look at whether you loved him or hated him, Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel, used to talk a lot about the head of the octopus. He had all these tentacles that were reaching out all across the Middle East, and they were all dangerous. And if you sat there trying to cut off one tentacle or another, the octopus was going to live. And right now, you were actually able to, like, when you can see your way because the skies over Lebanon are clear, the skies over Syria are clear, the skies over Iraq are clear, the skies over Iran are clear. You now have a clear path all the way to the head of the octopus. Now ask yourself, what are you going to do? Again, these are the sorts of strategic questions I think that the Israelis are now grappling with. they're being forced to address the Gaza issue and the displacement of Gazans and the rebuilding of Gazans and the day after. I got to tell you, as dire as it is for the Gazans, it's not where Israel probably needs to be focused right now. Israelis just came out of a war. I always called it Israel's Second War of Independence. I thought it was that almost from day one after October 7th. They're in many ways still fighting for their survival, much in the way that they did in 1948 and 1949. They never solved that last time around. That conflict did not end. It continued on a lower flame. Right now, there is an unbelievable opportunity. There's a window with the political alignment, with Israel's strength, relatively speaking, across the region. Big decisions need to be made, and those decisions will have reverberations across the entire Middle East. All of Israel's enemies, allies alike, are watching and waiting to see what the Israelis do.
Okay, what the Israelis do. Here's where I keep getting stuck. It doesn't seem to me, and I may be wrong, that the Israelis are going to be able to solve this problem themselves. It's a Gordian knot, if you want another analogy. I'm not sure they can do it alone. So doesn't this also mean that the US has decisions to make?
Yeah, I think so. And again, I get back to this. I believe that the meeting between Bibi and Trump in whatever that was, 4 weeks ago, was among the most consequential meetings ever to take place between an Israeli prime minister and an American president. Lots of decisions have been made in the Oval over the years between the leaders of our two countries. But this one right now, knowing that there's no way that Bibi didn't raise the specter of
Assume.
some kind of either a green light from the US to do what's necessary, or maybe even some kind of a collaborative approach to the challenge. Now, I will say there are people out there that are talking about, the US loaning a B-2 bomber with MOPs, that would allow Israel to attack. It's a little clever by half, in my view. I think that, at the end of the day, the US would be saddled with the same sort of responsibility in the eyes of the Iranians, whether we were the ones that dropped the weapon or the Israelis did it with weaponry that we provided them. I think from their perspective, it probably doesn't change much. Maybe the optics would be important here in the United States among isolationists. I don't know. But what we're looking at right now is that choice, whatever that choice looks like, however it's been described. And then there's the part that worries me, Shoshana, which is that our commander in chief is also the negotiator in chief. And I think the idea of negotiating a better deal, one that, really supersedes and is, in his mind, an improvement over what was achieved before by the likes of Barack Obama and, Biden failed to resurrect that deal. But I think there is a risk that Trump goes into negotiations with the Iranians, legitimizes the regime, allows them to play for time. These are the pitfalls that we watch for. But in the meantime, we know that the conversations are ongoing about action that Israel and the United States could take separately or together. And again, I think that the hastening of the conflict, or the renewal of the conflict over the next couple of weeks. And I do think we're probably looking at a couple of weeks before, both sides call it quits. Hamas and Israel say no more hostage, releases, no more of this. We're fighting again. And that's when I think the process of choosing the road ahead begins in earnest for both Bibi and Trump.
Okay, so shift your eyeballs left and right. Thank you. One of the things Trump has already done is impose back the waivers, the oil sale waivers, and China has drastically cut back its purchases of Iranian oil, and that's had an impact on the Houthis and it has an impact on Hezbollah. I mean, that's more complicated because Syria's also had an impact on Hezbollah. Is Trump softening the ground here? Is it possible to squeeze hard enough to alter the thinking of the Iranians, or do you foresee only a military response to this? Accepting, as you say, Trump might decide to be the negotiator in chief. That's one possibility.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about getting rid of the regime, is this possibly Trump ramping up to do it?
Look, he knows that maximum pressure last time around did a lot of good. And he's going right back to that playbook. And, again, I think the biggest challenge right now is just having the team to be able to implement it. But we're watching a regime that is, sort of squirming under the very powerful thumb of U.S. sanctions. So, whether that means that we're softening the ground, I don't know. What it is probably doing is it's forcing the Iranians to, as we always say, make choices between guns and butter. That in turn will weaken them at to the extent that they're choosing guns abroad, taking food out of the people at home. The suffering is passed down to the people. And this could put us in a position where we can support that maximum, or we can back the maximum support plan that we've talked about. This is the way that I think it. We need that leverage. Now, what the president decides to use, whether he uses that to renegotiate or whether he uses it to just simply continue to squeeze the regime until it's, I don't know what the word for uncle is in Farsi. But then they give up their nuclear program, for example. I do think that there's also a world in which the Trump administration tells Iran, we've given X weapons to the Israelis, or we've given them a green light to do X, Y, and Z. You have 1 week to end all of your nuclear, advances. You need to mothball everything and then hand it over, or you're going to pay a price. I don't know what kind of leverage Donald Trump wants to use. I don't know how he's thinking about this. I'm not sure he does either. You may have noticed that the frenetic pace of policies coming out of Washington, I mean, it is dizzying. The press can't keep up. Analysts like me cannot keep up. Our heads are spinning trying to get a handle on the changes that are coming to Washington. I cannot tell you exactly what our policy looks like as it relates to Europe, as it relates to Ukraine, as it relates to Israel, as it relates to Iran. There's a lot of statements, some of them conflicting, some of them not. We've got a lot to watch right now. But, I guess the one thing that I will say is
Going to make him repeat
advantage
that.
shifted toward
Wait,
Israel
you've got to
under the
wait.
current
You
and
froze
West.
for a second. You froze for a second. So I'm going to ask you to go back. You say one thing that you were going to say, and that's when you froze. So would you give us that one thing you were going to say again? The
I'm not sure.
last 35 seconds.
I just interrupted myself, which, I don't know how, I'm getting to that age. But I know I would just say that I think that everything has moved in the right direction for Israel politically. Militarily, they have more of what they need. They've got the leverage, and the U.S. has leverage. Again, this is now a question of where do they want to go? They're at this fascinating intersection of choices where it looks like they've got a lot of advantage. By the way, I mean, I'm curious about what Iran has up its sleeve right now. I'm curious about what some of Israel's and America's enemies have planned for whenever things end. But I see an advantage if I'm looking at this. If I have a decent enough picture, I see an advantage for Israel and the United States should they wish to press the issue with Iran.
So, as you know, I normally like to end the program with an optimistic point of view, and you just gave us one. So, I'm going to actually change my method of operation and ask you if you want to comment on Syria and the potential long-term potential in Syria that may or may not be an optimistic ending to the program. But I don't want to miss you mentioned Turkish Sanjaks. I don't want to miss your opinion on Syria.
No,
So.
thanks for asking. I mean, I'll give you the positive and negative.
Okay.
Okay.
Negative first so that we go out positive.
Okay. Negative is that the regime is Al-Qaeda and it is controlled by the Turks, who are increasingly not acting like NATO allies. I can't actually remember the last time they did act like NATO allies. They're terror-sponsoring state. They should be actually designated as such. And when you look at what's happening right now inside of Syria, you'll see that the lira, the Turkish currency, it's what's being used on the open market. When people are folks I know that have gone to Syria and taken meetings with the regime, there are Turkish advisors crawling all over the place. You know, the Israelis are talking about Syria as their Turkish neighbors. And that's a danger. There's no doubt that it is. And you know, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, I still like to call him by that name. It's his jihadi name. At the end of the day, when you look at his track record, it's not positive. And we all need to be very aware of the fact this is a regime that is acting in ways that we might describe as pragmatic now, but it's because they're weak and they need to have some time to get their feet under them. And at some point, we could see clashes. We could see conflict. We need to be aware of that. I think the Israelis are, but I think the US needs to be on similar footing, understanding that, you know, an Al-Qaeda regime, you know, this won't end well. I'm sorry. It just never does. The good news is that I think this offers the Israelis a really interesting opportunity to work with partners in the region that are fearful of the Turks. The Greeks, for example, a strong military in Europe, in NATO, they are on high alert right now. And I think this offers an opportunity for East Med cooperation in ways that we have not yet seen before. I am actually very bullish on the Greek-Israeli relationship for managing the East Med. I think the Saudis are very nervous about the Turks. I think the Emiratis are nervous about the Turks. So this gives us an opportunity to rethink alignments across the region. Again, when we talk about remaking the map, sometimes these negative things can actually lead to positive alliances, positive partnerships. So I see there some, I mean, when I start to think about Greece, Cyprus, Saudi, Emirates, Israel, all working together for a different kind of region, I like that a lot. That to me sounds like a really solid Middle East alliance, and one where the other countries that I just mentioned need Israel and they need American guidance. I like how that sounds. How's that for a positive ending?
That is a great positive ending. Also, we know now where to take our tourist dollars. We take them to Greece, right? So we can do that.
Really beautiful place, by the way, and not
Oh, it
just the
is.
islands. Athens is a blast too.
Greece is great. And people ask, you know, where can I go that I'm not going to feel like people don't like Jews? Greece is one of those places. So as we come to the end, Jonathan, thank you, not just for an optimistic ending, but for a really important look at the region, both the Gaza side and the war side, and also the potential for larger scale activity. Again, nobody knows where the Trump administration will end up, but we'll get there. It's going to end up someplace. So, as I thank you, let me ask our listeners to please join us next week. Our guest will be Ella Moore. She is the aunt of a hostage child who was released in the first group. The child's parents, unfortunately, were killed on October 7th, and she came into the world of hostage families. And she's going to talk about Israelis as people, the resilience of the Israeli people, and what's been going on for not for the country, not for the big stuff. Jonathan, you've been all over the region with us today, and I appreciate that, and that's really important. But Ella is going to go down to who are the Israeli people, what has happened to them since October 7th, how are they coping with the problems of October 7th. Not just the hostage families, but the whole country. So I hope you all will decide to join us again. And Jonathan Shanzer, you're great. Thank you.
You're great. Thank you.